Discussions about climate change quickly get beyond the idea of hotter days and into changing patterns in biology. Several bird experts have told us about the birds that used to inhabit more southerly climes showing up further north. Tree species are showing signs of inhabiting different habitats from their traditional ranges. Today we'll focus on wildflowers and plant diversity. Our guest this hour has studied the issue and the relationship extensively. Susan Harrison is a professor of environmental science and policy at the University of California, Davis. She has written or co-written a large number of academic articles and a book, Plant and Animal Endemism in California, published 3 years ago. She speaks tonight in Ashland at the library at 7, brought in by the Siskiyou Field Institute for a talk called The Future of Plant Diversity in a Hotter, Drier West. Thanks for joining us today, Susan Harrison.
Hi.
Hi, good to have you here. So we learn a new term quickly from your work, aridification, right, which seems pretty self-explanatory. Is this just dryness plus time, essentially?
Yeah, it refers to a drying trend over time and to the fact that you can sort of roll together to some extent the effects of a warming climate with what's going to happen to water supply. That's the big message that I would like to get across in the talk, is that when you talk about changing the temperature, you're not just making it hotter, you're effectively making it drier. And that's a reality that seems increasingly like the one that we're going to face over the next century.
So people shouldn't think in terms of drought and climate change as separate things. They really are connected.
No, there's been a real upsurge of the climatology literature in the last few years showing that temperature increases themselves contribute a great deal to water deficits, especially in parts of the world like the Western U.S., where there is already what's called a climatic water deficit. So that refers to the situation where during the growing season, during the time of year when it's warm enough for plants to grow, there is more demand for water from just evaporation and plants than precipitation and soil moisture supplies. So we live in a water deficit climate. It's dry during spring and summer. If plants had more water, they would grow more. That's a definition of a water deficit climate. What we do in a climate like that when we turn up the temperature is we increase that evaporative demand and therefore decrease the water balance that's available for plants and that's available as runoff to supply people and fish, et cetera. We also create longer, drier fire seasons, as we're increasingly beginning to see. So yeah, the real message is that one of the biggest impacts of a rising temperature for in terms of the natural world and also human interests is increasing dryness. Aridification is just the fancy way to say that.
Well, you know, when you put the arid in front of, you know, anything, it kind of makes sense after a while. But I never thought in terms of a water deficit kind of climate. But the fact is that it's been pointed out many times that in most of this region, when the rain falls is not the time that the plants grow. And so you need to save the water back. And that gets harder to do when there is less rain falling.
That's right. We actually live in a really remarkable climate called the Mediterranean type climate, only found in 5 parts of the world. And if you look at the graph that represents that type of climate, you see this big hump in water supply during the winter and this big hump in temperature during the summer. And there's just this little crossover point during spring, which is the time that plants go crazy and we get all the nice wildflowers and everything. And soil moisture storage plays this critical role in transitioning a little bit of that wintertime water into the spring and summer when plants need it. So just imagine the effects of making it warmer and drying out that soil faster and what that's going to do to the ability of plants to do the necessary growing that they need to do in the spring and summer to persist.
Is it something of a feedback loop in the sense that when we get in a cycle where things are getting warmer and drier, it tends to accelerate somewhat?
Well, there are some very powerful mechanisms of what we technically call positive feedbacks in the climate systems. Many reasons why when it gets warmer, that warming trend might tend to accelerate. And now I'm going to have to be very careful about switching between my expert hat, which is plant ecology, and my non-expert hat, but trying to follow the literature, which is climatology. But from my understanding, one of the single scariest positive feedback in the climate system, if you want to have something to keep you awake at night, is the frozen methane in the ocean at shallow depths. Now we're getting a long ways away from wildflowers in southern Oregon. But I'll tell you, if I'm lying awake at night needing something to worry about, I think about the frozen methane at shallow depths in the ocean, because when the ocean warms by a few degrees, even fractions of degrees, and that methane starts melting, that will be a huge release of a greenhouse gas into the climate system, which is exactly what you're saying. It's the reason why a gradual warming could turn into a catastrophic, very, very sudden warming. And interestingly, there is some evidence that this has happened in the geologic past and had drastic effects on the Earth's ecosystems.
And methane in particular, even a more obstructive gas for a greenhouse effect than carbon dioxide.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So let's bring it back into wildflowers. Back into your safety zone. I know as scientists you seek numbers, but the areas that you study, I mean, did they look different to you just upon heading out into them?
Yeah, so backing up a little bit for your listeners who may have neglected to read some of my recent scientific articles. I hope you guys will make this up, make up your lost time. But no, not being facetious here. For 15 years, I've been following a set of grassland sites in California within about a couple of thousand acre landscape. And I set them up originally to look at just ordinary ecological questions like how does grazing by cattle affect plant diversity? How does fire affect plant diversity? And then for various reasons, that study just sort of kept going and going, and pretty soon I had 15 years' worth of data. And that's when I looked at it and began to realize that something was going on with diversity of plants and that was related to climate. But meanwhile, I did about halfway through or so start to have a feeling that things were changing, just an intuitive hunch that when I went out there, I did not see as many fabulous wildflower displays as consistently as in the past. It also seemed to me on a very practical level that I was having to get out and do my field work in the middle of March instead of in the middle of April like I used to. And so I had this sort of sense, and I was wearing, you know, short-sleeved shirts and no jacket out there doing my field work more often. It was just maybe only a hunch, and I don't know if it could really be borne out with data. But then a few years later, when we actually did start looking at time trends in the data, sure enough, that's when we saw that plant diversity was declining and that it was statistically related to changes in climate.
All right, we're talking to Dr. Susan Harrison from the University of California, Davis, where she is a professor of environmental science and policy. And if you're looking for the articles, there's one called Climate-Driven Diversity Loss in a Grassland Community, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences last year, and there's some more recent stuff as well. She's put out a pile of stuff. We'll get into talking about much of that as we continue on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about climate change and diversity loss among plants. Back on the Exchange with Dr. Susan Harrison and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Susan Harrison from the University of California, Davis, has been studying wildflowers for many years in Northern California and noticing a loss of diversity over time that can be attributed to climate change and drought. And she's written a number of articles about this in science publications. And is talking about it tonight in Ashland on the future of plant diversity in a hotter, drier West, brought in by the Siskiyou Field Institute. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Ashland Library. You can join our conversation now on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So I come back to the interesting part of where your research ended up, because originally you were looking at things like grazing, you said, on the effect of the grasslands, and then you ended up noticing that things had changed over time. They just weren't the same after 15 years.
That's right. And over the course of my career in plant ecology, I've been interested in just about everything that affects plant diversity, the number of species and the identities of species that live together in a plant community. So everything from very small-scale things like localized disturbances, grazing, things like that, to soils. I'm very interested in these unusual serpentine soils that we have in southern Oregon and California that support unusual floras. But then all the way up to sort of large-scale evolutionary geographic processes that shape plant diversity, it's always been my interest to kind of see how those pieces fit together and what patterns are explained by large-scale things like the climate history of the Western U.S. versus how much is explained by things that happen sort of on a regular, everyday ecological timescale. And it just seems to me that the more you dig and the more you look, you just realize that climate is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, both over that very long scale of millions of years and then also in terms of what's happening now.
So just in sheer raw findings, I mean, are you just finding fewer species out there, fewer representatives of each species? I mean, what are some of the trends that you're noticing there?
That's right. So in the California grassland study, what we found, this is across 80 grassland sites in both serpentine and non-serpentine soils, where the serpentine has the really interesting, rich diversity of native species. Non-serpentine, a little more dominated by exotic annual grasses, but still with some good native diversity. But what we've seen over a 15-year course is a steady decline in the numbers of native annual species. So what we normally think of as wildflowers. There are fewer species on a per square meter basis. There's also fewer species when you sum up across all 80 sites. And that time trend actually correlates with what has been happening to winter precipitation over that time period. We can look at a number of climate trends over that period. We don't see a temperature trend until we open the time window a little wider and go back maybe 20 or 30 years. But over the 15-year period, what's happened is that we get these increasing numbers of long, dry spells during the winter. And if you just take that December through February precipitation and put it in a time series model, you find that it predicts both the decline in the number of species and it predicts the change in the identities of the species that are present. We can use some indicators of how drought tolerant each species in the community is, and we find that that index of drought tolerance is increasing over time. Or to put it the other way around, the drought intolerant species are the ones that tend to be dropping out.
And that was my next question, is whether they have dropped out entirely, where you just don't see any particular specimens of a certain species at all anymore.
No, we don't actually see disappearances from the entire landscape. What we see is that the landscape, just like here in Southern Oregon, is very heterogeneous. So you have cooler, lusher places, hotter, drier, south-facing slopes. And so at each site, you find a different set of species. But at each site, the species that are the least drought tolerant of the species at that site are the ones that are dropping out. So that means that most species are finding some place in the landscape where they're still hanging on. But overall, there's this this site-level change.
Susan Harrison's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about plant diversity in hotter, drier climates. Serpentine soil is an interesting thing for people who haven't been around it much. They've been around it, maybe not known it, but the fact is it's present in a lot of places in our region. Generally rather high in minerals and therefore not great for growing some things, but as you mentioned, some fairly wild diversity, which seems like a bit of a contradiction. But can you explain?
Sure. Now you've gotten me started on my favorite subject, so you're probably going to have to cut me off, but... Let's start at the beginning. Serpentine comes from the Earth's mantle. It's the rock that forms a very large percentage of the whole Earth, except that it doesn't really appear on the Earth's surface very much, except in places where plate tectonic interesting stuff has happened, which includes all of Western North America, a lot around here, a lot in southwestern Oregon.
So does volcanism bring it up?
No. One tectonic plate diving underneath another one brings it up. So during that tortuous process of plates coming together and one subducting beneath another, as it's called, some of the basement stuff, some of the ocean crust that's down there below all the other things, gets thrust up onto the surface. So in these mountain ranges that we have all throughout the throughout Western North America, you have tectonic subduction followed by mountain uplift, which then exposes some of the deep down and heavier rocks in the earth. So serpentine comes from this source, and it refers to the name refers to the fact that it can be sort of greenish and scaly and snakeskin-like. It can also look a variety of other ways. If you want to see some close to Ashland, you can go up to Big Red Mountain, just beyond Mount Ashland along the Siskiyou Crest, and see some fantastic plant communities. So the interesting thing about serpentine for plants is that it just has a very different mineral composition than the Earth's rocks. It has more magnesium, less iron. Many of the primary nutrients are much scarcer. Calcium is very scarce, and plants need calcium. They evolved on a Earth's surface that had lots of calcium. So when this calcium-poor rock from the ocean crust comes up, a lot of species just can't handle it. But then the species that evolve to handle these chemically unusual soils then have the opportunity to speciate, diversify, and form interesting communities that are rich in species that are found nowhere else.
Can they live in places that are not serpentine, or is the mineral mix they're looking for, if you'll pardon the animal expression,
right,
for a plant?
Right. Well, the classic story would be that these species that can handle nasty, harsh serpentine soils would be just perfectly fine, thank you, growing in better soils, but that it's competition with other plant species that prohibits them from doing so. So that would be a very, very big oversimplification, but that's sort of the classic story. So you have tall, fast-growing, dominant competitors on lush soils. that can't grow on the harsh soils. And that provides this opportunity for lots of interesting diversity to happen on the harsh soils.
Barbara in Grants Pass sent in an email. She says, would you please ask Dr. Harrison if plants, including the native bunch grasses that have adapted to the mineral imbalances and droughty conditions of Southwest Oregon's serpentine terrain, may fare better in a hotter, drier climate than species on more normal soils? And if she can say how the serpentine Darlingtonia wetlands will fare. Those are around $8 mountain,
right,
for example,
right.
Darlingtonia fens.
Right. Thank you so much for asking that, Barbara, because you've asked me about a subject that I've been, I and my lab have been fascinated by for about the last 10 years. So the question of whether, I'll rephrase it for you, whether the traits that allow plants to tolerate these harsh serpentine soils also might help them tolerate warmer, drier conditions. And I think the answer is yes. I don't think that serpentine plants or any plants are necessarily going to fare better under in our climate, under a hotter regime. However, what we find over and over again from many different sources of evidence is that these serpentine-tolerant plants are more resistant to changes in the climatic water balance. They don't decline as much as plants on lusher soils. And we think a primary reason for that is they have certain traits that are associated with being slow-growing, tough, stress tolerant, and that is, that gives them sort of a cross resistance to nasty soils and to water scarcity.
Let's talk about Darlingtonia. It is relatively rare, isn't it? Is it just in the Illinois Valley of Oregon?
No, it's found in various parts of the Sierra Nevada and the North Coast Range and Klamaths in California, and then also, of course, has some of its biggest populations in southwestern Oregon in Josephine County. It's very, very abundant where you find it. There are populations of millions of plants in some of these beautiful fens in Josephine County, for example. But geographically, it's extremely rare. It's only found in this, you know, region of several counties in Northern California and Southern Oregon. So it's a classic endemic, a species that is found nowhere else than in a restricted region. And it's a sort of a poster child for endemism because it's such a fabulous plant. It's so interesting. You look at these things. They're called cobra lilies. That's one of their common names because they look sort of like a cobra, and they're insectivorous. And the reason they grow where they grow is that these fens on serpentine soil, so places where there's moving water moving across serpentine soil, are very nutrient poor. And that's a perfect situation in which to trap your own protein as an insectivorous plant. That's the kind of environment where insectivorous plants flourish. Now, to put my optimist hat on, since I like every opportunity to put on an optimist hat, I think that some of these serpentine fens are fed by water that's sort of geologically deep. It's not just shallow surface water resulting from every year's rainfall. It's water that is moving through very deep systems in the cracks and fissures in these serpentine outcrops. And we could hope that there might be some more stability to the water that nourishes Darlingtonia populations than there is to the kind of shallow surface soil moisture that feeds most plant communities.
Dr. Susan Harrison, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of environmental science and policy at the University of California, Davis. She studies how plants fare, particularly wildflowers, with the advance of climate change, and she'll be talking about that tonight at the Ashland Library at 7 o'clock, brought in by the Siskiyou Field Institute, to talk about the future of plant diversity in a hotter, drier West. That's the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the discussion now. Questions of your own for the doctor about what's going on out there with wildflowers and plant diversity generally, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Pardon me if this was kind of a rudimentary question, but what are the specific mechanisms involved? We just talked about the plants getting dehydrated.
Yeah, so in the work in California, and I do want to mention also that I've done some similar work in Oregon, and we could talk about that. But in the work in California, dealing with these grassland communities that are dominated by annual species. Now, in this weird Mediterranean climate of ours, annual species tend to germinate in the fall, which people from other climates have a really hard time wrapping their head around. It greens up in fall, right? So annuals germinate, and then they sort of hang out as very small seedlings throughout most of the winter. They don't really put on a big burst of growth until spring when it's both warm enough and wet enough for them to reach maturity. So that means that during the winter, these annual species, these wildflowers, are present as tiny little seedlings with short little roots. Now, that's a time of year when, I think, historically, they may not have adapted to great dryness of that upper level of soil. And so when we see these longer periods of warmer, drier conditions during the wintertime, my fear is, and this is something I'm working on right now, but my fear is that the mechanism that we're talking about is that these seedlings are dying. They don't have their roots down deep enough to cope with several inches of dry surface soil. So that would be the pessimistic outlook, because if seedlings die before they mature, before they can reproduce, they're being taken out of the population. They're being taken out of the community. The seed bank is being depleted, and that means that there's not an easy potential for things to just kind of pop back to normal in a wet year. Now, the more optimistic interpretation would be that those seeds are just not germinating in the first place. And we do know that plants will hold off on germination in a very dry year. The moisture is one of the cues for germination. So that's a little bit more optimistic outlook, because it means that the seeds are still there in the soil. And so if the following year is wet, then they're still there. They're just hiding underground. So those are really the two possibilities. And I'm doing experiments right now and continued observations to try to disentangle those two. I suspect both of them are going on. I just hope that it's more seed dormancy and less seedling mortality, because seedling mortality is this one-way street toward lower diversity.
Yeah, just being dead as opposed to being able to come back from being asleep.
Yeah, that's right.
When you mention wetter years, which raises the big question, and I know it's been very unevenly distributed, that as you get closer to the state line, there's more water. Southern right. California really didn't see much of the effect of the El Nino. And in the area that you're studying, which I assume is somewhere around the latitude of Davis, mm-hmm. did you notice more rain this year? This past winter, and did it make much of a difference?
Yeah, we did have a wetter year this year in Northern California. The poor Southern Californians certainly didn't, and things are really dire down there. In my study area, in the region where I'm working, the rainfall from December through February was just a little below the long-term 30-year average, not much. So it was a virtually normal year. Then if you throw on what happened in the first 2 weeks of March, it was a rather wet year. We had very wet first 2 weeks of March. So overall, this should be a relatively good year. Now, in my sites that didn't burn, we can talk about fire later, in my sites that didn't burn, diversity really did not pop back up. It still stayed on the downward trend line, which really worries me, because it is consistent with the idea that the seed bank has gotten depleted, that species that might have responded favorably to a wet year 15 years ago have disappeared from the sites and therefore can't respond. They're not there anymore. However, now I'll give you the optimistic side. In my sites that did burn, because about half of them burned in these big Lake County fires that we had last summer, diversity did go back up substantially. It didn't go up to the level that we saw 15 years ago, but it went up quite a bit. Now, fire tends to be good for grassland diversity, because you get rid of all the sort of the dead material, the dead grass lying around on the soil surface. Everything that's in the seed bank will germinate the year after a fire. So you really have a window into the seed bank after a fire. And diversity did come up by an average of 2 to 4 species per site, 10, 20 or more percent. Sadly, I think that next year, assuming things don't burn again this year, which could always happen, but if it doesn't burn this year, I think those sites will go right back down to the diversity of 2 years ago, because it's a short-term response that you have after a fire. So overall, my hunch is still that we are on this downward trend, and that it might be caused by seedling mortality than by seed dormancy. But watch this space. I'll tell you. I'll come back in 5 years and tell you the answer.
We'll set the date today.
Okay.
How deep in the soil are you going? I wonder how far down you're looking at the levels of moisture and stuff like that. Uh-huh. Root depths, all that sort of thing.
Well, the conclusions and results I've been telling you about are more based on what happens to the plant community itself, and interpreting that in terms of the weather of the last 15 years. Those conclusions aren't based directly on my personal measurements of soil moisture. But now, of course, now that we're sort of on this research tangent, we are starting to measure soil moisture at depths of, one to several inches, because that's the depth that should be relevant to a seedling that's trying to survive through winter, waiting for spring to come along so that it can mature and flower.
What then happens to ecosystems that begin to transform into something other than what they have been? When you begin to lose certain species? I mean, you talk about, the potential for birds or lizards or any one of a number of other critters that depend on a certain kind of plant to survive. And so I wonder how much overall ecosystem change can be engendered by this process.
Yeah, well, again, this is something that I would like to look into more. Let me just start by saying that for maybe the last 20 or 30 years, ecologists, people in my field, have been increasingly interested in whether the diversity of plant communities has functional value or value for ecosystem services. So if you have more species in a community, will you get more of certain functions and outcomes than if you have fewer species? If you lose species, will that have real impacts beyond just, oh, there was a pretty species there and it's not there anymore? And so people have done literally hundreds of experiments asking this question. And oftentimes, I think more often than not, find that losing species can change things like soil decomposition rates, nutrient cycling, the diversity of things like pollinator species, soil microbes, the stability of the community over time can be reduced when it's less diverse than it used to be. So there's been great interest in showing that actually losing diversity is not just bad from a kind of a ethical or aesthetic or scientific perspective, but that it also might have functional significance that people might actually care about.
Yeah, beyond just, you know, geez, it's a shame to see this, but yeah, the fact is that it's going to make a difference all the way up the food chain.
Yeah, that's right. All right.
Dr. Susan Harrison, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from the University of California, Davis, speaking in Ashland tonight about the future of plant diversity in a hotter, drier West, which with a perhaps slight blip this year, we seem to be heading toward. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We'll come back and talk more with Dr. Harrison and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we return to the Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about climate change and plants with Dr. Susan Harrison, environmental science and policy professor at the University of California, Davis. She's written a large number of academic articles and a book, Plant and Animal Endemism in California. A couple of recent studies that we're looking at generally focusing on wildflowers and the diversity or lack thereof in parts of California near where she works, and how those project into what happens over time as things get hotter and drier. And in fact, her talk tonight in Ashland at the library at 7 o'clock is called The Future of Plant Diversity in a Hotter, Drier West. She's been brought in by the Siskiyou Field Institute. You can join our conversation on the Exchange. Your questions, your comments, your observations about what's going on with diversity in the wild and what's going on with drought as well are welcome. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned you have done some studies, not just in California, but also on the Oregon side as well, in the Illinois Valley?
That's right. This was work done about 2006 to 2010 or so with my friend Ellen Damshin from University of Wisconsin. And this is one of the studies that's becoming sort of popular to do in ecology these days, in which you find a historic data set from several decades ago, and you go back and revisit it and resample as much as possible the same sites several decades later, and you analyze what's changed and try to figure out some patterns. So we had the great good fortune that back in 1949 to 1951, a plant ecologist who later became eminent, Robert Whitaker, went to the Illinois Valley and sampled hundreds of sites to look at plant communities and how they just naturally varied along environmental gradients. He was actually very interested in how climate shaped plant communities, long before climate change came on anyone's horizon. And so he deliberately set up his sampling to capture lots of different gradients, from cool north-facing slopes to warm south-facing slopes, elevational gradients, coastal to interior gradients. And he also sampled these three really interesting botanically different soils: serpentine, gabbro, and diorite, which diorite is essentially the same thing as granite. And gabbro is something that's about halfway in between, chemically and botanically, serpentine and diorite. So he did all this sampling. He published a paper in 1960 that was mainly concerned with methods for analyzing how plant communities vary along gradients. And then we dug out his data, which was located in the basement of the Rare Documents Library at Cornell University, entered it all into a database, and then took off on an adventure that lasted several years, where we went around the area of the Caves Monument, which is where most of his non-serpentine sites were, and the Weimer Road area, or Josephine Ophiolite area, if anybody's familiar with that region, sort of west of O'Brien, between O'Brien and the coast, which is where his serpentine sites were. And also $8 Mountain, which is sort of a botanical pilgrimage site. And fortunately for us, he had sampled there, and we got to sample there too. And we ended up, over the course of a couple of years, resampling about 200 of Whitaker's sites. Most of the ones, virtually all the ones that hadn't been logged, and then some of the ones that had been logged between Whitaker's time and ours. And we were interested in really any explanation, any interpretation for ecological change over time. Ecological change over time is fascinating, whatever its causes are. And so we looked at patterns in a whole number of different ways. We used aerial photos to try to interpret what had happened to forest canopy cover, how that influenced things. What we came up with were, and they were, by the way, we're looking at the herb communities that live under the forest canopy. And we found two things. Compared to Whitaker's data, we found a lot less diversity, a lot fewer species per site than Whitaker had. In fact, such a drastic drop-off that I was kind of worried that maybe we'd done something wrong.
Like you thought you'd sampled the wrong places or something?
Or that maybe our technique wasn't identical to his. But the thing was, he described his technique very, very clearly, and it was very unambiguous. When we would resample, we would all get the same results. It didn't vary from person to person. So we thought it was pretty good. But the other thing that we found was that the species composition had changed in just the same way that I described in California, that there are these various indicators of how drought tolerant or intolerant a species is. And in all the measures that we looked at, three different measures, plant communities today look less drought intolerant, more drought tolerant than the ones that Whitaker sampled. So the species that are disappearing on a site-by-site basis tend to be the ones that have the traits that make you think they are going to suffer the most. And in that area, what we've seen climatically since Whitaker's time, since the last 50 or 60 years, is there has been a steady, I mean, a not steady, but there has been an overall directional increase in temperature. There hasn't been an overall change in precipitation, but precipitation has shifted a bit in terms of its winter versus spring distribution. Snowpack has declined drastically, and there's a snowpack monitoring station smack in the middle of Whitaker's study area that shows a very clear decline since his time. So we think there's plenty of reason to believe that these same sorts of things, a warmer, drier climate has unfolded in that region too. And the changes that we saw in those communities are very consistent with warming and drying as an explanation. And qualitatively, they're exactly the same results we found in the California study.
In no case do you get warmer and wetter, I'm assuming. It tends to always run in the direction. When it gets warmer, it's always going to get drier.
Well, here's the thing is if you have a climate where there's already a surplus of water, where there's there's so much water that plants never experience a water deficit. Then if you make it warmer, you're not making it drier. You're actually making it better for plants. It'd be like a greenhouse. Like, it's great. It's warm. It's wet. And you'll actually increase plant productivity. But when you already have a climate that's a water deficit climate, such as we have, that's where increasing the temperature has the effect of making the soils drier, increasing the water deficit, putting plants under more drought stress.
Grab the headphones. We have a call for you. Let's put Rose in O'Brien on the air with Dr. Susan Harrison. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. I believe I met you when you were out in O'Brien. That's where I live. I do studies at the Rough and Ready, and you are right. There are species of flowers that if they die out, it will definitely affect other insects. Of course, you're familiar with buzz pollination.
Right.
We have insects that hit a frequency of vibration with their wings when they touch the flower so that the pollen will filter down and collect onto them. Yes, they will definitely be affected. And I just wanted to say that I'm glad to have you in our community again, and thank you.
Well, thanks very much for that comment.
Appreciate the call, Rose. So pollinators, how much have you studied what they're doing? I know you're generally on the plant science side of things, right?
Well, I haven't studied that directly myself, and it's partly kind of a logistical thing that if pollinators decline, they're going to decline over a large area. You can't just study it on a sort of plot-by-plot basis. You kind of have to study over a large area, and you have to study it over a long period of time to see that decline. And if I had started collecting pollinator data 15 years ago, then maybe I'd now be able to say, well, the pollinators have declined too. But since I haven't been doing that for the last 15 years, I simply don't have the data to be able to say that. However, there's a lot of people, like tons of ecologists studying the effects of climatic shifts on plant-pollinator interactions. And it's not just a question of the plants disappearing. It's a matter of also the plants flowering. either less predictably or at different times of year. Phenology is the fancy word that we use for the seasonal timing of important ecological events. Shifts in phenology are going to be a problem for pollinators, for any species that depend on other species, because it's not guaranteed that they're going to shift their phenology in the same way. So if the plants flower too early, the bees will miss them, things like that.
So when we talk about cycles and systems changing, I did find myself wondering, when you're looking at the test sites in both California and in Oregon, if perhaps, as we talk about bird species moving into more northerly ranges from where they used to be because they're looking for for the conditions they're used to, if you see any of that sort of thing going on, have you and other scientists have traded enough information to indicate that maybe the kinds of wildflowers you see at latitude X are now at latitude X point, X plus 5?
Yeah, and we have to be – that's a great question, and we have to be really careful when we think about species shifting their geographic distributions, because that can happen for either of two reasons. They could be moving to those higher latitudes and higher elevations. Then we'll see a net shift. Or they could just be disproportionately dying out at lower elevations and lower latitudes. And that will also lead to a net shift. But it's not like the species is doing real well. It's not like it's moving and tracking the climate. It's just its distribution is changing because of dying out in the warmer parts of its range. And in the literature, in the broad literature, I mean, there's been so many studies now. There's been many, even like whole review papers of all the studies of shifting distributions. And across those hundreds of studies, there are strong net patterns, what's called a meta-analysis, where you throw all the results together and say statistically, is there a signal across many studies? Yes, there is. Species have moved, in quotes, tens of kilometers closer to the poles and tens to greater than that meters in elevation over the last 50 years. So there is a net effect. My sense from the literature is that for plants, it's more that they're disappearing from the warmer parts of their range than that they're actively, successfully tracking the expansion into the cooler aspects, because plants just don't move as well.
No, that's true. They certainly can't do what birds can do, although they know birds can carry parts of them. Email question from Laura in Mount Shasta wants to know if you can talk about the differences between snowpack versus rainfall when considering moisture patterns for plant survival.
Sure. There's a great study from Europe by Harald Pauli et al. That deals with this. It was a really important paper for my thinking about things. So Harald Pauli is one of a consortium of scientists that call themselves GLORIA. I can't remember exactly what the acronym is, but GLORIA is such a nice name. But it's now a global consortium of people who have set up study plots on the tops of mountains to look at climate change. So it's been going on in Europe for the longest. They've been publishing, I think the first paper I saw from the GLORIA scientists in Europe was in 1994. And they started publishing results saying, hey, you know, as the climate has warmed in Europe, plant diversity on mountain peaks has actually gone up. Well, now, a couple of years ago, 2012, they published a paper saying, oh, now we've added some more GLORIA observatories in more southerly parts of Europe, in warmer, drier parts of Europe where mountaintops are not snowy. And in those settings, plant diversity is consistently going down. So what's going on? It's actually very explainable by kind of climatic or bioclimatic first principles. If you take a mountaintop in snowy, cold northern Europe where plant growth is limited by low temperatures, and you warm that up, you're making things more productive and favorable for plants, and more plants are going to be able to live there than they could historically. But if you take the same warming and impose it on a warmer, drier mountaintop without a snowpack, you're just increasing the moisture deficit, as we've talked about. You're making it a less favorable environment. So we see this elevational shift from warming causing increased plant productivity at high snowy elevations to the same warming causing decreased plant productivity at lower water-limited elevations.
Not surprisingly, one of the first responses I saw to what we're talking about here on our Facebook page was the standard belief that, oh, you know, it's just drought, it's just cyclical, we'll come back. I mean, I know we're getting a little outside of your range of expertise, but based on what you know from other scientists, what do you think?
Well, I would refer that commenter to a recent paper by Cook et al., Science Advances 2015. They reconstruct the 1,000-year record of drought in western North America using tree rings. They're able to reconstruct something called the Palmer Drought Severity Index, which you can also calculate from climate. They use the 20th century as a way to calibrate that connection between climatic variables and these long-term droughts. And indeed, over the last 1,000 years, there have been 5, 6 maybe major droughts about as roughly as significant as the one that we've recently seen. Then they project the Palmer Drought Severity Index into the future using what we know about the relationship between temperature, rainfall, and soil moisture. And they show that 100 years from now, there's a steady decrease in soil moisture, a steady increase in this drought severity index, such that 100 years from now, the expected level of drought every single year is going to be 2 to 3 times greater than we have seen in the last few years. It's simply going to get drier and drier and drier. This is also emphasized recently in a talk that I saw by Glenn McDonald from UCLA, who's a member of the National Academy. What I've just said is exactly the point of his talk. He said, there's no reason to expect that our present drought will ever end. It's going to simply get worse. And that's, again, it's not because of what's happening to precipitation over time. It's because of how temperature affects drought. That's what's different.
So, in the half minute we have left, what do we do? Do we begin seed banking a lot of wildflowers, for example, to make sure that they don't die out completely?
Yeah, there are already people who are doing that. Kew Gardens in England has a long-term seed storage project just to make sure that we keep some species diversity around for whatever sort of future we end up living in. I think it might also be time to at least start thinking about how we do ecological restoration. I hate to see people go out, spend a lot of time doing restoration, putting out species that are adapted to a past climate that are not going to live in the future climate. So maybe we need to sort of rethink how we approach conservation and restoration to really take on board the reality of what the future is going to be like.
Well, you've given us a great deal to think about today. Susan Harrison is a professor of environmental science and policy at the University of California, Davis. Her talk tonight in Ashland at the library at 7 is called The Future of Plant Diversity in a Hotter, Drier West. Thanks so much for giving us a preview here in the Exchange today.